No, she said. Not right away. He talked for a while, remember? She turned to Nate. He asked you if you put the cell phones in our backpacks, the ones that got us in trouble with Mr. Avery.
The cell phones? Right. Officer Budapest scratches something down in his notebook.
He doesn't say it like a question, but Bronwyn explains anyway. Somebody played a prank on us, she says. It's why we were in detention. Mr. Avery found phones in our backpacks that didn't belong to us. She turns to Principal Gupta with an injured expression. It really wasn't fair. I've been meaning to ask, is that something that goes on your permanent record?
Nate rolls his eyes. It wasn't me. Someone stuck a phone in my backpack, too.
Principal Gupta furrows her brow. This is the first I'm hearing about this.
I shrug when she meets my eyes. Those phones were the last thing on my mind these past few days.
Officer Budapest doesn't look surprised.
Mr. Avery mentioned that when I met with him earlier. He said none of the kids ever claimed the phones, so he thought it must have been a prank after all.
He slides his pen between his index and middle finger and taps it rhythmically against the table.
Is that the sort of joke Simon might have played on you all?
I don't see why, Addie says. There was a phone in his backpack, too. Besides, I barely knew him. You were on junior prom court with him, Bronwyn points out. Addie blinks, like she's only just remembering that's true.
Any of you kids ever have trouble with Simon? Officer Budapest asks. I've heard about the app he made. About that, right?
He's looking at me, so I nod.
You guys ever been on it?
Everyone shakes their head except Nate.
Lots of times, he says.
What for? Officer Budapest asks. Nate smirks.
Stupid shit.
He starts, but Principal Gupta cuts him off. Language, Mr. McCauley.
Stupid stuff, Nate amends. Hooking up, mostly. Did that bother you? Being gossiped about?
Not really. He looks like he means it. I guess being on a gossip app isn't a big deal compared to getting arrested. If that's true. Simon never posted it, so nobody seems to know exactly what Nate's deal is. Kind of pathetic how Simon was our most trusted news source. Officer Budapest looks at the rest of us.
But not you three.
We all shake our heads again.
Did you ever worry about ending up on Simon's app? Feel like you had something hanging over your heads or anything like that?
Not me, I say, but my voice isn't as confident as I would have liked. I glance away from Officer Budapest and catch Addie and Bronwyn looking like polar opposites. Addie's gone pale as a ghost, and Bronwyn's flushed brick red. Nate watches them for a few seconds, tilts his chair back, and looks at Officer Budapest.
Everybody's got secrets, he says. Right?
My workout routine goes long that night, but my dad makes everyone wait till I'm done so we can eat dinner together. My brother, Lucas, clutches his stomach and staggers to the table with a long-suffering look when we finally sit down at 7. The topic of conversation's the same as it's been all week. Simon.
You had to figure the police would get involved at some point,
Pop says, spooning a small mountain of mashed potatoes onto his plate.
Something's not right about how that boy died, he snorts.
Peanut oil in the water system, maybe? Lawyers are going to have a field day with that.
Were his eyes bugging out of his head like this?
Asks Lucas, making a face. He's 12, and Simon's death is nothing but video game gore to him. My grandmother reaches over and swats Lucas on the back of his hand. Nani's barely 5 feet tall with a head full of tight white curls, but she means business.
Hush your mouth unless you can speak of that poor young man with respect.
Nani's lived with us since we moved here from Mississippi 5 years ago. It surprised me then that she came along. Our grandfather had been dead for years, but she had plenty of friends and clubs that kept her busy. Now that we've lived here for a while, I get it. Our basic colonial costs 3 times what our house in Mississippi did, and there's no way we could afford it without Nani's money. But you can play baseball year-round in Bayview, and it's got one of the best high school programs in the country. At some point, Pop expects I'll make this gigantic mortgage and the job he hates worthwhile. I might. After my fastball improved by 5 miles an hour over the summer, I ended up fourth on ESPN's predictions for the June MLB draft next year. I'm getting scouted by a lot of colleges, too, and wouldn't mind heading there first. But baseball's not the same as football or basketball. If a guy can head for the minors right out of high school, he usually does. Pop points at me with his knife.
You got a showcase game Saturday. Don't forget.
As if I could. The schedule's posted around the whole house. Kevin, maybe one weekend off, my mother murmurs, but her heart's not in it. She knows it's a losing battle.
Best thing Cooperstown can do is business as usual, Pop says. Slacking off won't bring that boy back, God rest his soul.
Nani's small, bright eyes settle on me.
I hope you realize none of you kids could have done anything for Simon, Cooper. The police have to dot their I's and cross their T's, that's all.
I don't know about that. Officer Budapest kept asking me about the missing EpiPens and how long I was by myself in the nurse's office. Almost like he thought I might have done something with them before Ms. Grayson got there. But he didn't come out and say it. If he thinks someone messed with Simon, I'm not sure why he isn't looking at Nate. If anybody asked me, which they didn't, I'd wonder how a guy like Nate even knew about EpiPens in the first place. We've just finished clearing the table when the doorbell rings, and Lucas sprints for the door, hollering,
I'll get it!
A few seconds later, he yells again,
It's Keeley!
Nani rises to her feet with difficulty, using the skull-topped cane Lucas picked out last year when she faced up to the fact that she couldn't walk on her own anymore.
Thought you said you two didn't have plans tonight, Cooper.
We didn't, I mutter as Keeley enters the kitchen with a smile, wrapping her arms around my neck in a tight hug.
How are you?
She murmurs in my ear, her soft lips brushing my cheek. I've been thinking about you all day.
Okay,
I say. She pulls back and reaches into her pocket, briefly flashing a cellophane packet and a smile. Red vines, which are definitely not part of my nutritional regimen, but my favorite candy in the world. The girl gets me. And my parents, who require a few minutes of polite conversation before they head out for their bowling league. My phone chimes, and I pull it out of my pocket. Hey, handsome. I duck my head to hide the grin that's suddenly tugging at my mouth, and text back, Hey. Can I see you tonight? Bad time. Call you later? Okay. Miss you. Keeley's talking to my mother, her eyes bright with interest. She's not faking it. Keeley isn't only beautiful, she's what Nani calls sugar all the way through. A genuinely sweet girl. Every guy at Bayview wishes he were me. Miss you too.
Chapter 4 Addie. Thursday, September 27th, 7:30 p.m. I should be doing homework before Jake stops by, but instead I'm sitting at the vanity in my bedroom, pressing fingers to the skin at my hairline. The tenderness on my left temple feels as though it's going to turn into one of those horrible, oversized pimples I get every few months or so. Whenever I have one, I know it's all anyone can see. I'll have to wear my hair down for a while, which is how Jake likes it anyway. My hair is the only thing I feel 100% confident about all the time. I was at Glenn's diner last week with my girlfriends, sitting next to Keeley across from the big mirror, and she reached over and ran a hand through my hair while grinning at our reflections. Can we please trade, just for a week? She said. I smiled at her, but wished I were sitting on the other side of the table. I hate seeing Keeley and me side by side. She's so beautiful. All tawny skin and long eyelashes, and Angelina Jolie lips. She's the lead character in a movie, and I'm the generic best friend whose name you forget before the credits even start rolling. The doorbell rings. but I know better than to expect Jake upstairs right away. Mom's going to capture him for at least 10 minutes. She can't hear enough about the Simon situation. And she'd talk about today's meeting with Officer Budapest all night if I let her. I separate my hair into sections and run a brush along each length. My mind keeps going back to Simon. He'd been a constant presence around our group since freshman year, but he was never one of us. He had only one real friend, a sort of goth girl named Janae. I used to think they were together until Simon started asking out all my friends. Of course, none of them ever said yes. Although last year, before she started dating Cooper, Keely got super drunk at a party and let Simon kiss her for 5 minutes in a closet. It took her ages to shake him after that. I'm not sure what Simon was thinking, to be honest. Keely has one type, jock. He should have gone for someone like Bronwyn. She's cute enough, in a quiet kind of way, with interesting gray eyes, and hair that would probably look great if she ever wore it down. Plus, she and Simon must have tripped over each other in honors classes all the time. Except I got the impression today that Bronwyn didn't like Simon much. Or at all. When Officer Budapest talked about how Simon died, Bronwyn looked, I don't know, not sad. A knock sounds at the door, and I watch it open in the mirror. I keep brushing my hair as Jake comes in. He pulls off his sneakers and flops on my bed with exaggerated exhaustion, arms splayed at his sides.
Your mom's wrung me dry, Ads. I've never met anyone who can ask the same question so many ways.
Tell me about it, I say, getting up to join him. He puts an arm around me and I curl into his side, my head on his shoulder and my hand on his chest. We know exactly how to fit together. And I relax for the first time since I got called into Principal Gupta's office. I trail my fingers along his bicep. Jake's not as defined as Cooper, who's practically a superhero with all the professional-level working out he does. But to me, he's the perfect balance of muscular and lean. And he's fast, the best running back Bayview High's seen in years. There's not the same feeding frenzy around him as Cooper, but a few colleges are interested, and he's got a good shot at a scholarship.
Mrs. Kelleher called me, Jake says.
My hand halts its progress up his arm as I stare at the crisp blue cotton of his T-shirt. Simon's mother? Why?
She asked if I'd be a pallbearer at the funeral. It's going to be Sunday,
Jake says, his shoulders lifting in a shrug.
I told her sure. Can't really say no, can I?
I forget sometimes that Simon and Jake used to be friends in grade school and middle school, before Jake turned into a jock and Simon turned into whatever he was. Freshman year, Jake made the varsity football team and started hanging out with Cooper, who was already a Bayview legend after almost pitching his middle school team to the Little League World Series. By sophomore year, the two of them were basically the kings of our class, and Simon was just some weird guy Jake used to know. I half think Simon started about that to impress Jake. Simon found out one of Jake's football rivals was behind the anonymous sexting harassment of a bunch of junior girls and posted it on this app called After School. It got tons of attention for a couple of weeks, and so did Simon. That might have been the first time anyone at Bayview noticed him. Jake probably patted him on the back once and forgot about it. And Simon moved on to bigger and better things by building his own app. Gossip as a public service doesn't go very far, so Simon started posting things a lot pettier and more personal than the sexting scandal. Nobody thought he was a hero anymore, but by then, they were getting scared of him. And I guess for Simon, that was almost as good. Jake usually defended Simon, though. When our friends got down on him for about that,
it's not like he's lying, he'd point out. Stop doing sneaky shit, and it won't be a problem.
Jake can be pretty black and white in his thinking sometimes. Easy, when you never make a mistake.
We're still headed for the beach tomorrow night, if that's okay,
he tells me now, winding my hair around his fingers. He says it like it's up to me, but we both know Jake's in charge of our social life. Of course, I murmur. Who's going? Don't say TJ.
Cooper and Keely are supposed to, although she's not sure he's up for it. Luis and Olivia. Vanessa, Tyler, Noah, Sarah.
Don't say TJ.
And TJ.
Arr. I'm not sure if it's my imagination or if TJ, who used to be on the outskirts of our group as the new kid, has started working his way into the center right when I wish he'd disappear altogether. Great, I say blandly, reaching up and kissing Jake's jawline. It's the time of day when it's a little scratchy, which is new this year. Adelaide! My mother's voice floats up the stairs. We're heading out! She and Justin go somewhere downtown almost every night. Usually restaurants, but sometimes clubs. Justin's only 30 and still into that whole scene. My mother enjoys it almost as much, especially when people mistake her for being Justin's age. Okay, I call, and the door slams. After a minute, Jake leans down to kiss me, his hand sliding under my shirt. A lot of people think Jake and I have been sleeping together since freshman year, but that's not true. He wanted to wait until after junior prom. It was a big deal. Jake rented a fancy hotel room that he filled with candles and flowers and bought me amazing lingerie from Victoria's Secret. I wouldn't have minded something a little more spontaneous, I guess, but I know I'm beyond lucky to have a boyfriend who cares enough to plan every last detail.
Is this okay?
Jake's eyes scan my face.
Or would you rather just hang out?
His brows rise like it's a real question, but his hand keeps inching lower. I never turn Jake down. It's like my mother said when she first took me to get birth control. If you say no too much, pretty soon someone else will say yes. Anyway, I want it as much as he does. I live for these moments of closeness with Jake. I'd crawl inside him if I could. More than okay, I say, and pull him on top of me.
Nate, Thursday, September 27th, 8 p.m. I live in that house. The one people drive past and say, I can't believe someone actually lives there. We do. Although living might be a stretch. I'm gone as much as possible, and my dad's half dead. Our house is on the far edge of Bayview, the kind of shitty ranch rich people buy to tear down. Small and ugly, with only one window in front. The chimney's been crumbling since I was 10. 7 years later, everything else is joining it. The paint's peeling, shutters are hanging off, the concrete steps in front are cracked wide open. The yard's just as bad. The grass is almost knee-high and yellow after the summer drought. I used to mow it sometimes, until it hit me that yard work is a waste of time that never ends. My father's passed out on the couch when I get inside. An empty bottle of Seagram's in front of him. Dad considers it a stroke of luck that he fell off a ladder during a roofing job a few years ago, while he was still a functioning alcoholic. He got a workman's comp settlement and wound up disabled enough to collect Social Security, which is like winning the lottery for a guy like him. Now he can drink without interruption while the checks roll in. The money's not much, though. I like having cable, keeping my bike on the road, and occasionally eating more than mac and cheese, which is how I came to my part-time job, and why I spent 4 hours after school today distributing plastic bags full of painkillers around San Diego County. Obviously not something I should be doing, especially since I was picked up for dealing weed over the summer and I'm on probation. But nothing else pays as well and takes so little effort. I head for the kitchen, open the refrigerator door, and pull out some leftover Chinese. There's a picture curling under a magnet, cracked like a broken window. My dad, my mother and me when I was 11. Right before she took off. She was bipolar and not great about taking her meds, so it's not as though I had some fantastic childhood while she was around. My earliest memory is her dropping a plate, then sitting on the floor in the middle of the pieces, crying her eyes out. Once I got off the bus to her throwing all our stuff out the window. Lots of times she'd curl up in a corner of her bed and not move for days. Her manic phases were a trip, though. For my 8th birthday, she took me to a department store, handed me a cart, and told me to fill it with whatever I wanted. When I was 9 and into reptiles, she surprised me by setting up a terrarium in the living room with a bearded dragon. We called it Stan, after Stan Lee, and I still have it. Those things live forever. My father didn't drink as much then. So between the two of them, they managed to get me to school and sports. Then my mother went totally off her meds and started getting into other mind-altering substances. Yeah, I'm the asshole who deals drugs after they wrecked his mother. But to be clear, I don't sell anything except weed and painkillers. My mother would have been fine if she'd stayed away from cocaine. For a while, she came back every few months or so. And once a year. The last time I saw her was when I was 14 and my dad started falling apart. She kept talking about this farm commune she'd moved to in Oregon, and how great it was, that she'd take me and I could go to school there with all the hippie kids and grow organic berries or whatever the hell they did. She bought me a giant ice cream sundae at Glenn's Diner, like I was 8 years old. And told me all about it. You'll love it, Nathaniel. Everyone is so accepting. Nobody labels you the way they do here. It sounded like bullshit even then. But better than Bayview. So I packed a bag, put Stan in his carrier, and waited for her on our front steps. I must have sat there half the night, like a complete fucking loser. Before it finally dawned on me, she wasn't going to show. Turned out that trip to Glenn's Diner was the last time I ever saw her. While the Chinese heats up, I check on Stan, who's still got a pile of wilted vegetables and a few live crickets from this morning. I lift the cover from his terrarium and he blinks up at me from his rock. Stan is pretty chill and low maintenance, which is the only reason he's managed to stay alive in this house for 8 years. What's up, Stan? I put him on my shoulder, grab my food, and flop into an armchair across from my comatose father. He has the World Series on, which I turn off because A, I hate baseball, and B, it reminds me of Cooper Clay, which reminds me of Simon Kelleher and that whole sick scene in detention. I'd never liked the kid, but that was horrible. When Cooper was almost as useless as the blonde girl when you come right down to it. Bronwyn was the only one who did anything except babble like an idiot. My mother used to like Bronwyn. She'd always notice her at school things. Like the nativity play in 4th grade, when I was a shepherd and Bronwyn was the Virgin Mary. Someone stole baby Jesus before we were supposed to go on, probably to mess with Bronwyn because she took everything way too seriously even then. Bronwyn went into the audience, borrowed a bag, wrapped a blanket around it, and carried it around as if nothing had happened. That girl doesn't take crap from anyone, my mother had said approvingly. Okay, in the interest of full disclosure, I stole baby Jesus. And it was definitely to mess with Bronwyn. It would have been funnier if she'd freaked out. My jacket beeps, and I dig in my pockets for the right phone. I almost laughed in detention on Monday when Bronwyn said nobody has 2 cell phones. I have 3. One for people I know, one for suppliers, and one for customers. Plus extras so I can switch them out. But I wouldn't be stupid enough to take any of them into Avery's class. My work phones are always set to vibrate, so I know it's a personal message. I pull out my ancient iPhone and see a text from Amber, a girl I met at a party last month. You up? I hesitate. Amber's hot and never tries to hang out too long, but she was just here a few nights ago. Things get messy when I let casual hookups happen more than once a week. But I'm restless and could use a distraction. Come over, I write back. I'm about to put my phone away when another text comes through. It's from Chad Posner, a guy at Bayview I hang out with sometimes. You see this? I click on the link in the message, and it opens a Tumblr page with the headline, About This. I got the idea for killing Simon while watching Dateline. I've been thinking about it for a while, obviously. That's not the kind of thing you pluck out of thin air. But the how of getting away with it always stopped me. I don't kid myself that I'm a criminal mastermind, and I'm much too good-looking for prison. On the show, a guy killed his wife. Standard Dateline stuff, right? It's always the husband. But turns out lots of people were happy to see her gone. She'd gotten a coworker fired, screwed over people on city council, and had an affair with a friend's husband. She was a nightmare, basically. The guy on Dateline wasn't too bright. Hired someone to murder his wife, and the cell phone records were easy to trace. But before those came out, he had a decent smoke screen because of all the other suspects. That's the kind of person you can get away with killing. Someone everybody else wants dead. Let's face it, everyone at Bayview High hated Simon. I was just the only one with enough guts to do something about it. You're welcome. The phone almost slips out of my hand. Another text from Chad Posner came through while I was reading. People are fucked up. I text back, where'd you get this? Posner writes, some rando emailed a link with the laughing so hard I'm crying emoji. He thinks it's somebody's idea of a sick joke, which is what most people would think if they hadn't spent an hour with a police officer asking 10 different ways how peanut oil got into Simon Kelleher's cup, along with 3 other people who looked guilty as hell. None of them have as much experience as I do keeping a straight face when shit's falling apart around them. At least none of them are as good at it as me.
Chapter 5 Bronwyn Friday, September 28th, 6:45 p.m. Friday evening is a relief. Maeve and I are settled into her room for a Buffy the Vampire Slayer marathon on Netflix. It's our latest obsession, and I've been looking forward to it all week. But tonight we only half pay attention. Maeve's curled up on the window seat, tapping away on her laptop, and I'm sprawled across her bed with my Kindle open to Ulysses by James Joyce. It's number one on the Modern Library's 100 Best Novels, and I'm determined to finish it before the semester's over. But it's pretty slow going, and I can't concentrate. All anybody could talk about at school today was that Tumblr post. A bunch of kids had the link emailed to them last night from some About This Gmail address, and by lunchtime everyone had read it. Yumiko helps out in the principal's office on Fridays, and she heard them talking about trying to track whoever did it by IP address. I doubt they'll have any luck. Nobody with half a brain would send something like that from their own technology. Since detention on Monday, people have been careful and overly nice to me. But today was different. Conversations kept stopping when I approached. Yumiko finally said, "It's not like people think you sent it. They just think it's weird how you guys got questioned by the police yesterday, and then this pops up." Like that was supposed to make me feel better. Just imagine. Maeve's voice startles me back to her bedroom. She puts aside her laptop and wraps her fingers lightly on the window. This time next year, you'll be at Yale. What do you think you'll do there on a Friday night? Frat party? I roll my eyes at her. Right, because you get a personality transplant along with your acceptance letter. Anyway, I still have to get in. You will. How could you not? I shift restlessly on the bed. Lots of ways. You never know. Maeve keeps tapping her fingers against the glass. If you're being modest on my account, you can give it a rest. I'm quite comfortable in my role as the family slacker. You're not a slacker, I protest. She just grins and flutters a hand. Maeve's one of the smartest people I know, but until her freshman year, she was too sick to go to school consistently. She was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 7, and wasn't fully disease-free until 2 years ago, when she was 14. We almost lost her a couple of times. Once, when I was in 4th grade, I overheard a priest at the hospital asking my parents if they'd considered starting to make arrangements. I knew what he meant. I bowed my head and prayed. Please don't take her. I'll do everything right if you let her stay. I'll be perfect. I promise. After so many years in and out of the hospital, Maeve never really learned how to participate in life. I do that for both of us. Join the clubs, win the awards, and get the grades so I can go to Yale like our parents did. It makes them happy and keeps Maeve from extending herself too much. Maeve goes back to staring out the window with her usual faraway expression. She looks like a daydream herself, pale and ethereal, with dark brown hair like mine, but startling amber eyes. I'm about to ask what she's thinking when she suddenly sits up straight and cups her hands around her eyes, pressing her face against the window. Is that Nate McCauley? I snort without moving, and she says, I'm serious. Check it out. I get up and lean in next to her. I can just about make out the faint outline of a motorcycle in our driveway. What the hell? Maeve and I exchange glances, and she shoots me a wicked grin. What? I ask. My voice comes out more snappish than I intended. What? She mimics. You think I don't remember you mooning over him in elementary school? I was sick, not dead. Don't joke about that. God. And that was light years ago. Nate's motorcycle is still in our driveway, not moving. What do you suppose he's doing here? Only one way to find out. Maeve's voice is annoyingly sing-songy, and she ignores the dirty look I give her as I stand up. My heart thumps all the way downstairs. Nate and I have talked more at school this week than we have since 5th grade, which, admittedly, still isn't much. Every time I see him, I get the impression he can't wait to be someplace else. But I keep running into him. Opening the front door triggers a floodlight in front of our garage that makes Nate look as though he's on center stage. As I walk toward him, my nerves are jangling, and I'm acutely conscious of the fact that I'm in my usual hanging out with Maeve ensemble, flip-flops, a hoodie, and athletic shorts. Not that he's making an effort. I've seen that Guinness T-shirt at least twice this week. Hi, Nate, I say. What's up? Nate takes his helmet off, and his dark blue eyes flick past me to our front door. Hey. He doesn't say anything else for an uncomfortably long time. I cross my arms and wait him out. Finally, he meets my gaze with a wry smile that makes my stomach do a slow somersault.
I don't have a good reason for being here.
Do you want to come in? I blurt out. He hesitates.
I bet your parents would love that.
He doesn't know the half of it. Dad's least favorite stereotype is that of the Colombian drug dealer, and he wouldn't appreciate even a hint of association from me. But I find myself saying,
They're not home. Then I hastily add, I'm hanging out with my sister, before he thinks that was some sort of come-on. Yeah, okay. Nate gets off his bike and follows me like it's no big deal. So I try to act equally nonchalant. Maeve's leaning against the kitchen counter when we get inside, even though I'm sure she was staring out her bedroom window 10 seconds ago. Have you met my sister Maeve? Nate shakes his head. No. How's it going? All right, Maeve answers, eyeing him with frank interest. I have no idea what to do next as he shrugs off his jacket and tosses it over a kitchen chair. How am I supposed to entertain Nate McCauley? It's not even my responsibility, right? He's the one who showed up out of the blue. I should do what I normally do. Except that sit in my sister's room and watch retro vampire shows while half-reading Ulysses. I'm completely out of my depth here. Nate doesn't notice my discomfort, wandering past the French doors that open into our living room. Maeve elbows me as we follow him and murmurs, Que boca tan hermosa. Shut up, I hiss. Dad encourages us to speak Spanish around the house, but I doubt this is what he had in mind. Besides, for all we know, Nate's fluent. He stops at the grand piano and looks back at us. Who plays? Bronwyn, Maeve says before I can even open my mouth. I stay near the doorway, arms folded as she settles into Dad's favorite leather armchair in front of the sliding door leading to our deck. She's really good.
Oh, yeah?
Nate asks at the same time I say, No, I'm not. You are, Maeve insists. I narrow my eyes and she widens hers in fake innocence. Nate crosses to the large walnut bookcase covering one wall, picking up a picture of Maeve and me with identical gap-toothed smiles in front of Cinderella's castle at Disneyland. It was taken 6 months before Maeve was diagnosed, and for a long time it was the only vacation picture we had. He studies it, then glances my way with a small smile. Maeve was right about his mouth. It is sexy.
You should play something.
Well, it's easier than talking to him. I shuffle to the bench and sit, adjusting the sheet music in front of me. It's variations on the canon, which I've been practicing for months now. I've taken lessons since I was 8, and I'm pretty competent technically, but I've never made people feel anything. Variations on the canon is the first piece that made me want to try. There's something about the way it builds, starting soft and sweet, but gaining in volume and intensity until it's almost angry. That's the hard part, because at a certain point the notes grow harsh, verging on discordant, and I can't muster the force to pull it off. I haven't played it in over a week. The last time I tried, I hit so many wrong notes, even Maeve winced. She seems to remember, glancing toward Nate and saying, This is a really hard song. As if she suddenly regrets setting me up for embarrassment. But what the hell? This whole situation is too surreal to take seriously. If I woke up tomorrow and Maeve told me I'd dreamed it all, I'd fully accept that. So I start, and right away it feels different, looser and less of a reach for the harder parts. For a few minutes, I forget anyone's in the room and enjoy how notes that usually trip me up flow easily. Even the crescendo. I don't attack it as hard as I need to, but I'm faster and surer than I normally am, and don't hit a single wrong note. When I finish, I smile triumphantly at Maeve, and it's only when her eyes drift toward Nate that I remember I have an audience of two. He's leaning against our bookcase, arms crossed, and for once he doesn't look bored or about to make fun of me.
That's the best thing I've ever heard, he says.
Addie, Friday, September 28th, 7 p.m. God, my mother. She's actually flirting with Officer Budapest, of the pink freckled face and receding hairline. Of course, Adelaide will do anything to help, she says in a husky voice, trailing one finger around the rim of her wine glass. Justin's having dinner with his parents, who hate Mom and never invite her. This is his punishment, whether he knows it or not. Officer Budapest stopped by just as we finished the vegetable pad Thai Mom always orders when my sister Ashton comes to visit. Now he doesn't know where to look, so he's got his eyes fixed on a dried flower arrangement on the living room wall. My mother redecorates every 6 months, and her latest theme is shabby chic with a weird beachy edge. Cabbage roses and seashells as far as the eye can see.
Just a few follow-up points, if you don't mind, Addie, he says.
Okay, I say. I'm surprised he's here, since I thought we'd already answered all his questions. But I guess the investigation's still going strong. Today, Mr. Avery's lab was blocked off with yellow tape, and police officers were in and out of school all day. Cooper said Bayview High's probably going to get into trouble for having peanut oil in the water or something. I glance at my mother. Her eyes are fixed on Officer Budapest, but with that distant expression I know well. She's already mentally checked out, probably planning her wardrobe for the weekend. Ashton comes into the living room and settles herself in an armchair across from me. Are you talking to all the kids who were in detention that day? She asks. Officer Budapest clears his throat.
The investigation is ongoing, but I'm here because I had a particular question for Addie. You were in the nurse's office the day Simon died, is that right?
I hesitate and dart a glance toward Ashton, then look back at Officer Budapest. No.
You were, Officer Budapest says. It's in the nurse's log.
I'm looking at the fireplace, but I can feel Ashton's eyes boring into me. I wind a strand of hair around my finger and tug nervously. I don't remember that.
You don't remember going to the nurse's office on Monday?
Well, I go a lot, I say quickly. For headaches and stuff? It was probably for that. I scrunch my forehead like I'm thinking hard and finally meet Officer Budapest's eyes. Oh, right. I had my period and I was cramping really bad, so yeah, I needed Tylenol. Officer Budapest is a blusher. He turns red as I smile politely and release my hair.
And you got what you needed there? Just the Tylenol?
Why do you want to know? Ashton asks. She rearranges a throw pillow behind her so the starfish pattern, made out of actual seashells, isn't digging into her back.
Well, one of the things we're looking into is why there appeared to be no EpiPens in the nurse's office during Simon's allergy attack. The nurse swears she had several pens that morning, but they were gone that afternoon.
Ashton stiffens and says, "You can't possibly think Addie took them." Mom turns to me with a faintly surprised air, but doesn't speak. If Officer Budapest notices that my sister has stepped into the parenting role here, he doesn't mention it.
Nobody's saying that. But did you happen to see whether the pens were in the office then, Addie? According to the nurse's log, you were there at 1 o'clock.
My heart's beating uncomfortably fast, but I keep my tone even. I don't even know what an EpiPen looks like. He makes me tell him everything I remember about detention again, then asks a bunch of questions about the Tumblr post. Ashton's all alert and interested, leaning forward and interrupting the whole time, while Mom goes into the kitchen twice to refill her wine glass. I keep looking at the clock, because Jake and I are supposed to be going to the beach soon, and I haven't even started touching up my makeup. My pimple's not going to cover itself. When Officer Budapest finally gets ready to leave, he hands me a card.
Call if you remember anything else, Addie, he says. You never know what might be important.
Okay, I say, sliding the card into the back pocket of my jeans. Officer Budapest says goodbye to Mom and Ashton as I open the door for him. Ashton leans against the doorframe next to me, and we watch Officer Budapest get into a squad wagon and start slowly backing out of our driveway. I spy Justin's car waiting to pull in behind Officer Budapest, and that gets me moving again. I don't want to have to talk to him, and I still haven't fixed my makeup, so I escape upstairs with Ashton following behind me. My bedroom is the biggest one in our house except the master, and used to be Ashton's until I took it over when she got married. She still makes herself at home there as if she'd never left. "You didn't tell me about that Tumblr thing," she says, sprawling across my wide eyelet bedspread and opening the latest issue of Us Weekly. Ashton is even blonder than me, but her hair is cut in chin-length layers that our mother hates. I think it's cute, though. If Jake didn't love my hair so much, I'd consider a cut like that. I sit at my vanity and dab concealer on my hairline pimple. Somebody's being a creep, that's all. "Did you really not remember being in the nurse's office? Or did you just not want to answer?" Ashton asks. I fumble with the concealer cap, but I'm saved from answering when my phone blares its Rihanna only girl text tone from the bedside table. Ashton picks it up and reports, "Jake's almost here." "God, Ash!" I glare at her in the mirror. "You shouldn't look at my phone like that. What if it was private?" "Sorry," she says, in a completely not sorry tone. "Everything okay with Jake?" I twist in my chair to face her, frowning. "Why wouldn't it be?" Ashton holds a palm up at me. "Just a question, Addie. I'm not implying anything." Her tone darkens. "No reason to think you'll turn out like me. It's not as though Charlie and I were high school sweethearts." I blink at her in surprise. I mean, I've thought for a while that things weren't going well between Ashton and Charlie. For one thing, she's suddenly here a lot. And for another, he was hardcore flirting with a slutty bridesmaid at our cousin's wedding last month. But Ashton's never come out and admitted a problem before. "Are things, really bad?" She shrugs, dropping the magazine and picking at her nails. "It's complicated. Marriage is way harder than anyone tells you. Be thankful you don't have to make life decisions yet." Her mouth tightens. "Don't let Mom get in your ear and twist everything. Just enjoy being 17. "I can't. I'm too afraid it's all going to be ruined. That it's already ruined. I wish I could tell Ashton that. It would be such a relief to get it out. I usually tell Jake everything, but I can't tell him this. And after him, there's literally not one other person in the world I trust. Not any of my friends, certainly not my mother, and not my sister. Because even though she probably means well, she can be awfully passive-aggressive about Jake." The doorbell rings, and Ashton's mouth twists into a half-smile. "Must be Mr. Perfect," she says. Sarcastic, right on schedule. I ignore her and bound down the stairs, opening the door with a big smile I can't help when I'm about to see Jake. And there he is, in his football jacket, with his chestnut hair tousled by the wind, giving me the exact same smile back.
"Hey, baby."
I'm about to kiss him when I catch sight of another figure behind him and freeze.
"You don't mind if we give TJ a ride, do you?"
A nervous laugh bubbles up in my throat and I push it down. "Of course not." I go in for my kiss, but the moment's ruined. TJ flicks his eyes toward me, then at the ground.
"Sorry about this. My car broke down and I was gonna stay home, but Jake insisted..."
Jake shrugs.
"You were on the way. No reason to miss a night out because of car trouble."
His eyes travel from my face to my canvas sneakers as he asks,
"Are you wearing that, Ads?"
It's not a criticism, exactly, but I'm in Ashton's college sweatshirt, and Jake's never liked me in shapeless clothes. "It'll be cold at the beach," I say tentatively, and he grins.
"I'll keep you warm. Put on something a little cuter, huh?"
I give him a strained smile and go back inside, mounting the stairs with dragging steps because I know I haven't been gone long enough for Ashton to have left my room. Sure enough, she's still flipping through Us Weekly on my bed, and she knits her brows together as I head for my closet. Back so soon? I pull out a pair of leggings and unbutton my jeans. I'm changing. Ashton closes the magazine and watches me in silence until I exchange her sweatshirt for a form-fitting sweater. You won't be warm enough in that. It's chilly tonight. She snorts out a disbelieving laugh when I slip off my sneakers and step into a pair of strappy sandals with kitten heels. You're wearing those to the beach? Is this wardrobe change Jake's idea? I toss my discarded clothes into the hamper, ignoring her. Bye, Ash. Addie, wait! The snarky tone's gone from Ashton's voice, but I don't care. I'm down the stairs and out the door before she can stop me, stepping into a breeze that chills me instantly. But Jake gives me an approving smile and wraps an arm around my shoulders for the short walk to the car. I hate the entire ride. Hate sitting there acting normal when I want to throw up. Hate listening to Jake and TJ talk about tomorrow's game. Hate when the latest Fall Out Boy song comes on and TJ says, I love this song, because now I can't like it anymore. But mostly, I hate the fact that barely a month after my and Jake's momentous first time, I got blind drunk and slept with TJ Forrester. When we get to the beach, Cooper and Luis are already building a bonfire, and Jake heaves a frustrated grunt as he shifts into park.
They do it wrong every time, he complains, launching himself out of the car toward them. You guys, you're too close to the water.
TJ and I get out of the car more slowly, not looking at each other. I'm already freezing and wrap my arms around my body for warmth.
Do you want my jack?
TJ starts, but I don't let him finish. No. I cut him off and stalk toward the beach, almost tripping in my stupid shoes when I reach the sand. TJ is at my side, arm out to steady me. Addie, hey. His voice is low, his minty breath briefly on my cheek.
It doesn't have to be this awkward, you know? I'm not going to say anything.
I shouldn't be mad at him. It's not his fault. I'm the one who got insecure after Jake and I slept together, and started thinking he was losing interest every time he took too long to answer a text. I'm the one who flirted with TJ when we ran into each other on this exact same beach over the summer while Jake was on vacation. I'm the one who dared TJ to get a bottle of rum and drank almost half of it with a Diet Coke chaser. At one point that day, I laughed so hard I snorted soda out of my nose, which would have disgusted Jake. TJ just said in this dry way,
Wow, Addie, that was attractive. I'm very turned on by you right now.
That was when I kissed him and suggested we go back to his place. So really, none of this is his fault. We reach the edge of the beach and watch Jake douse the fire so he can rebuild it where he wants. I sneak a glance at TJ and see dimples flash as he waves to the guys.
Just forget it ever happened, he says under his breath.
He sounds sincere, and hope sparks in my chest. Maybe we really can keep this to ourselves. Bayview's a gossipy school, but at least about that isn't hanging over everybody's heads anymore. And if I'm being 100% honest, I have to admit, that's a relief.
Chapter 6
Cooper, Saturday, September 29th, 4:15 p.m. I squint at the batter. We're at full count and he's fouled off the last two pitches. He's making me work, which isn't good. In a showcase game like this, facing a right-handed second baseman with so-so stats, I should have mowed him down already. Problem is, I'm distracted. It's been a hell of a week. Pops in the stands and I can picture exactly what he's doing. He'll have taken his cap off, knotting it between his hands as he stares at the mound, like burning a hole into me with his eyes is going to help. I bring the ball into my glove and glance at Luis, who catches for me during regular season. He's on the Bayview High football team, too, but got permission to miss today's game so he could be here. He signals a fastball, but I shake my head. I've thrown 5 already, and this guy's figured everyone out. I keep shaking Luis off until he gives me the signal I want. Luis adjusts his crouch slightly, and we've played together long enough that I can read his thoughts in the movement. Your funeral, man. I position my fingers on the ball, tensing myself in preparation to throw. It's not my most consistent pitch. If I miss, it'll be a big fat softball and this guy'll crush it. I draw back and hurl as hard as I can. My pitch heads straight for the middle of the plate, and the batter takes an eager, triumphant swing. Then the ball breaks, dropping out of the strike zone and into Luis's glove. The stadium explodes in cheers, and the batter shakes his head like he has no idea what happened. I adjust my cap and try not to look pleased. I've been working on that slider all year. I strike the next hitter out on 3 straight fastballs. The last one hits 93, the fastest I've ever pitched. Lights out for a lefty. My stats through 2 innings are 3 strikeouts, 2 groundouts, and a long fly that would have been a double if the right fielder hadn't made a diving catch. I wish I could have that pitch back. My curveball didn't curve. But other than that, I feel pretty good about the game. I'm at Petco, the Padres stadium, for an invitation-only showcase event, which my father insisted I go to even though Simon's memorial service is in an hour. The organizers agreed to let me pitch first and leave early, so I skip my usual post-game routine, take a shower, and head out of the locker room with Luis to find Pop. I spot him as someone calls my name.
Cooper Clay?
The man approaching me looks successful. That's the only way I can think to describe him. Sharp clothes, sharp haircut, just the right amount of a tan, and a confident smile as he holds his hand out to me.
Josh Langley with the Padres. I've spoken to your coach a few times.
Yes, sir. Pleased to meet you, I say. My father grins like somebody just handed him the keys to a Lamborghini. He manages to introduce himself to Josh without drooling, but barely.
Hell of a slider you threw there, Josh says to me. Fell right off the plate.
Thank you, sir.
Good velocity on your fastball, too. You've really brought that up since the spring, haven't you?
I've been working out a lot, I say, building up arm strength.
Big jump in a short time, Josh observes.
And for a second, the statement hangs in the air between us like a question. Then he claps a hand on my shoulder.
Well, keep it up, son. Nice to have a local boy on our radar. Makes my job easy. Less travel.
He flashes a smile, nods goodbye to my dad and Luis, and takes off. Big jump in a short time. It's true. 88 miles per hour to 93 in a few months is unusual. Pop won't shut up on the way home, alternating between complaining about what I did wrong and crowing about Josh Langley. He winds up in a good mood, though, more happy about the Padres scout than upset about someone almost getting a hit off me.
Simon's family gonna be there?
He asks as he pulls up to Bayview High.
Pay our respects if they are.
I don't know, I answer him. It might just be a school thing.
Hat off, boys,
Pop says. Luis crams his into the pocket of his football jacket, and Pop wraps the steering wheel impatiently when I hesitate.
Come on, Cooper. It might be outside, but this is still a service. Leave it in the car.
I do as I'm told and get out, but as I run a hand through my hat hair and close the passenger door, I wish I had it back. I feel exposed, and people have already been staring at me enough this week. If it were up to me, I'd go home and spend a quiet evening watching baseball with my brother and Nani. But there's no way I can miss Simon's memorial service when I was one of the last people to see him alive. We start toward the crowd on the football field, and I text Keeley to find out where our friends are. She tells me they're near the front, so we duck under the bleachers and try to spot them from the sidelines. I have my eyes on the crowd and don't see the girl in front of me until I almost bump into her. She's leaning against a post, watching the football field with her hands stuffed into the pockets of her oversized jacket. Sorry, I say, and realize who it is. Oh. Hey, Leah.